UW-Madison Campus Voices mission is to capture, present, and preserve some of the strongest historical stories and memories of UW-Madison through the people who lived them. Campus Voices, a project of the UW-Madison Oral History Program, consists of presenting extant archival material in 21st century formats, such as a podcast, mini-movie, and iTunes album.
This is the UW-Madison Campus Voices podcast. I'm Troy Reeves, head of the Oral History Program at the UW-Madison Archives, and today's host. I really, really wanted some cool Ira Glass-esque introduction here, capturing my wit and wisdom and setting the stage for our first podcast, which is our interpretation of the 1970 Teaching Assistants Association, or TAA, strike. I even recorded some takes, and let me tell you, in my mind, they were all destined for the podcast Introduction Hall of Fame. But what I found is a story with so much depth that my words only detracted from this piece and added to its length. So maybe next time podcast listeners will get a chance to hear me in my full throat. One group I do need to laud before we embark, the Brittingham Fund, whose generous support made this podcast, as well as our current TAA Strike iTunes album, and soon-to-be-published mini-movie possible. Some of their generosity helped me to hire three current and former graduate students to repackage and present our TAA Strike archival material in the three aforementioned ways. So without further ado, here's the producers and presenters of this podcast: Katie Gleichman, recent library school graduate; Ellen Jacks, current library school student; and Megan Falater, current history graduate student. And now to discuss the seeds of the TAA strike, here's Ellen.
For academics at UW-Madison, the title of TA offered a mark of honor, a training opportunity, and a means of financial support.
Well, we had some ideas about the TAs. Our ideas about the TAs, I think, probably are still shared by many members of our faculty.
This is C. William Loomer, former professor of agricultural economics.
This is that a TA, a teaching assistant appointment, is basically a kind of an award that you make, something you have to offer promising graduate students as a means of supporting them while they finish their graduate studies. It's not quite like a scholarship. They have to work in a different sort of way, but it's, at least in my part of the university, not very much different between a TA and a research assistant. I mean, they're awards that are really tied in with your program as a graduate student.
A TA position would certainly keep a graduate student in school for the duration of their academic careers, but in the mid-1960s, graduate students faced the responsibility of possibly ending other students' college educations. Male students who received failing grades from their TAs could lose student draft deferment status and be sent to Vietnam. In May 1966, 35 graduate students at UW-Madison organized the Teaching Assistants for the Reevaluation and Renewal of Education, TARRE, and, quote, threatened to withhold grades until they are no longer a life or death issue, unquote. Henry Haslack, a mathematics TA, explained.
Some of the TAs felt that by giving Fs to people, they were sending them to Vietnam, so they felt that they had a special problem, and they formed to decide how they were going to deal with that, and they separately sent some statement to the chancellor, I believe, at that time.
The graduate students soon acknowledged that they faced other problems as TAs and reorganized as the Teaching Assistants Association on June 28, 1966. In November of that year, the TAA drafted a general statement detailing their primary demands, which included educational reform and bread-and-butter issues such as job security, evaluation and firing procedures, and wages. According to Patricia Russian, a TA in the German department, TAs did not receive sufficient compensation for their work.
And because of the L&S pay scale chart, which had been developed about 15 years ago, and which had not been updated, the salaries in all kinds of departments, but especially the foreign languages, in no way reflected the amount of work that was being put in. For instance, in German, the scale for German was based on a time when in the German department, teaching assistants were paired up and taught a class together. Mm-hmm. And so, essentially, they only taught half the hours class met. By the time I was here, the teaching assistants were teaching all the hours, and on our own, we were just trying to run the courses. I mean, the course chairmen, in many cases, were totally incompetent, and we were developing our own materials. I mean, we were easily putting in twice as much time.
Administrators knew of these issues for graduate students. In 1966, the university set up a committee to review the working conditions of the TAs. The committee distributed their findings in 1968. The report, named after committee chair and associate dean in the College of Letters and Science, also known as LNS, Edward Mulvihill, identified some of the problems that TAs faced in the mid-1960s, such as wide differences in working conditions and expectations among departments. The Mulvihill Report also offered specific recommendations to improve TAs' experience and training at the university. Despite these efforts, few administrators and professors seemed willing to take action on the problems faced by TAs. Dean Mulvihill.
The reason they didn't feel it was a particular problem was because they didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I still feel that way. I have to say that it was very significant to me that when this report finally came out and ultimately was distributed to the entire faculty, I have no direct statistics to be able to know how many faculty members actually read that report. But I think there were very few in number.
Yet to 1966 and the beginning of 1967, members of the TAA did not recognize the indifference of some faculty administrators to their concerns. The association underwent fast political and ideological changes in its first years. Again, Henry Haslack.
That was a fairly moderate, in the real sense of the word. I mean, these people in that first year felt that they could write up this model contract, take it to the chancellor, and it would be instituted.
Mm-hmm.
And in 67, a lot of people from the left got involved and took the position that a traditional trade union was reactionary, which was a very common feeling among the new left at that time, and said what the TAA should be is an ad hoc organization, still use labor techniques, but not go for a contract, because a contract is a very restrictive document.
TAA members soon used these labor techniques to support educational reform or educational planning, the most controversial of their platforms. TAA members wanted graduate students to have some control over course content, not only in discussion sections, but with entire courses and departments. This control was normally within faculty purview.
The TAA was primarily an educational reform organization from summer of 67 through the January 69.
The politics and platform of the TAA kept it very small, with as few as 10 members as of January 1969. But this changed with the news of legislation proposed by John Shabazz, the Republican Assistant Majority Leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly.
The legislature decided that it was going to cut out-of-state tuition remissions. In other words, everybody would have to pay out-of-state tuition, which was a big chunk of money. And we were down to about eight people then, seven people from English, which was very politically active at the time, and myself.
Blaming out-of-state students for the protests occurring on UW campuses in the late 1960s, Shabazz and his conservative supporters hoped that this legislation would also reduce protests on campus. This proposal frightened graduate students whose studies depended on the financial support provided by assistantships. The TAA responded quickly to the Shabazz proposal.
So we thought that the right thing to do was to take a strike vote. So we put up ballot boxes in all the departments and took a strike vote over this and announced that 1,500 TAs, it was about 2,200 at the time, or not that many, that's a chance of testing, probably 2,000, we're going to go on strike. And
how many did vote for the strike vote?
I have no idea. I never saw the ballots.
Oh.
Could have been that many. I never counted
them. Maybe it might have been seven.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Facing a booming TAA membership and a strike vote at his university, Chancellor H. Edwin Young found it increasingly difficult to dismiss the association. Yet this is precisely what he wished to do. A former professor of economics and director of the School for Workers, he cared less for the graduate students' demands than he did for the broader population. Chancellor Young.
I was concerned with our continued relation with the rest of the labor movement. And so in my dealings with the TAs, I always had to act very carefully that I didn't appear to be anti-labor.
In March 1969, the TAA sought to begin collective bargaining with the university. Young refused to grant the union university recognition, but eventually agreed to do so if the TAA underwent an election sponsored by the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission, also known as WERC. This election would determine whether the entire population of TAs at the university, and not just its members, wanted union representation.
I never can consider a student union a bona fide trade union for this reason, that the turnover is such that the people you're dealing with across the table have no investment in the future. I don't think collective bargaining works if either the employer or the employees aren't going to be there in the future.
More than half of the university's TAs voted in the election in May 1969. The TAA received 1,209 valid ballots, with 931 voting for union representation. The 931 students were not only a majority of the students who voted, but also a narrow majority of the entire TA population that year. With this election, the TAA gained a structure agreement that allowed the union to form a collective bargaining relationship with the university, which Katie will continue.
No unionized graduate students had successfully bargained with their university before. What the TAA attempted was a departure from the traditional relationship between students and universities. Not surprisingly, then, TAA members had no experience in bargaining. Their leftist politics encouraged them to structure their union as a participatory democracy, so the members of their negotiating team changed frequently. Some students attended a majority of the bargaining sessions, but others filtered in and out. Graduate students from industrial relations joined the TAA following the work election, however, and greatly improved its bargaining talent. The university, in contrast, created an advisory Council of 30, which represented each department on campus with 15 or more TAs, and a Council of 10, which represented the LNS departments that relied heavily on TAs, as well as representatives from the schools of education and engineering, to engage in the bargaining process with the TAA. The Council of 10 included some faculty and students trained in labor negotiations, as well as other faculty members. Negotiations soured as early as July 1969. That month, UW-Madison sent a memo to all department chairs that directed them to not negotiate with the TAA. Union members complained that the university was engaging in bad faith organizing. TAA members brought bread and butter as well as educational reform demands to the bargaining table. While the former was the less controversial of the two, TAA's request for resources such as sufficient office space also created upset among some faculty who lacked the same resources. Yet the TAA lost most support for its call for educational reform. Professor James Stern, a former member of the Industrial Relations Research Institute, argued that the TAA's focus actually hurt students' cause.
They may have gotten some support and yet at the same time failed to get greater support. If they had been emphasizing health insurance and wages, things of this nature, although wages really wasn't even on the table as a bargaining issue, they probably could have gotten trade union support. But when they argued about control of the educational process, they were talking to union leaders who were the parents of college students who didn't particularly want these young TAs running classes, and told them so.
The TAA lost not only labor allies, but also support from faculty for its call for educational reform. Pat Russian.
We had thought that the major difficulty in the contract would be getting more money for different things. We found that even though everything was very tough to get, that our clauses having to do with money wound up being the easier ones to get. The one that was impossible to get, essentially, was our educational planning clause. And in retrospect, it was very clear why that was so tough, but we were so naive then as not to understand that anything that would fundamentally alter the power relationships of the university would be the most threatening.
The university and TAA bargaining teams met through the fall 1969 semester. Robert Doremus, former professor of English and associate dean of LNS, participated in these negotiations.
As I recall, we bargained every Thursday afternoon, normally. This was, of course, before the strike, during the winter leading up to the strike. And we had Council of Ten meetings on the Tuesday before the Thursday to discuss what had gone on the previous session, to discuss strategy, to go over proposed new clauses for the bargaining, which Bucklew or others might have written up for our consideration. Now, the TAA kept wanting evening sessions. I don't know whether it was more convenient for them or whether, as has been said, none of the new left gets up before 11 in the morning and they run late at night. We had a suspicion that perhaps they wanted to try to wear us out with evening sessions. At any rate, we consistently refused, except that there was one or two evening meetings just before the strike.
Faculty administrators at the university also criticized TAA bargaining tactics. Most of the members of the Council of Ten were faculty rather than trained negotiators, and some were shocked by their interactions with bargaining graduate students. This is Professor Stern.
You see, one of the things they could do instead of calling them Professor so-and-so is address them by their first name.
Yeah.
And that would stop the professor. But in basic labor management relations, you're supposed to be talking about an interaction between equals. And
yeah,
typically you do call each other by the first name. So something that seems quite indecent to a senior faculty member to have his former graduate research assistant saying, "Hey, Bob, what are you doing about that?" Would be normal for labor relations.
Professor Doremus also complained that TAA members used abusive language during bargaining sessions. Other faculty defended the students, however.
But Doremus is a typical English professor. He's not a labor negotiator. And he would be bothered by the language of any labor negotiator.
The bargaining teams did not reach an agreement in 1969. The TAA decided to end negotiations on January 8, 1970, and later set a strike deadline for March 15th. In early March, the TAA held a vote in which a majority of members expressed their willingness to strike. On the day that the ballots were tallied, March 9th, the union asked the university to renew negotiations. At this point, bargaining had already resolved many issues, and the TAA received more concessions from the university in the days and hours leading up to the strike deadline. Professor Stern.
The main bread and butter issues were being solved in a way which I don't think the TAs really thought they could gain. They had the whole loaf of bread, so to speak. Unfortunately, from their point of view, that they were not able to say, "Look, we've made a great victory. We've won everything that all TAs wanted," because outstanding was this issue of academic control of classes. And once we got it down to that issue, the faculty was not about to give that up, and the faculty was ready to support the administration completely. And the strike ensued, and there was nothing to do but to wait it out until the students were ready to come back to work.
Yet former physics TA David Burris believed that there is much to gain through a strike.
Now, what does it mean to say it could have been solved? We got a lot more in our contract by striking than we would have got than we could have ever settled for. We could have got them to offer a bit more than they did offer, I think, if we'd gone in hat in hand playing nice guys instead of playing tough guys.
Mm.
But we played them as tough people all along, and we said that you're going to have to do more than this, and we're going to make you do it.
Some faculty resented the idea of a strike and argued that it did not originate with ordinary graduate students. Here is Lester Seifert, professor of German.
There were professional organizers involved, no doubt. Both professional organizers and, professional rousers.
University administrators argued that the TAA strike was illegal. They terminated bargaining sessions on March 16th and sought a legal injunction against the strike. The TAA did not receive support from many local unions. The UW Blue Collar Workers Union, for example, did not join the strike. The Teamsters did, but withdrew support after 2 weeks. Leaders of the TAA did not organize this strike on a whim. They wanted a greater role in educational reform, but also fought for TA security as workers. Again, David Burris.
Because most of these issues, the real bad issue was control of the jobs and the departments without enough money. The TA was patronage.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that increases a professor's power at the expense of a teaching assistant, a graduate assistant. So there's a direct conflict, and I don't see any way to settle it except by a strike to find out what the real power relations are.
TAA members picketed campus during the weeks of the strike. The university did not centrally track attendance or confirm whether its TAs held discussion sections or office hours, though it did confirm a large reduction in the number of rooms used for section meetings. But some rooms were still used. Not all graduate students went on strike, and many other members of the university continued with their work during these weeks. Even some of the picketers held discussion sections for their students, both on and off campus. The strike did not affect TA's concerns for their undergraduate students.
You know, especially the first week of the strike.
This is Pat Russian.
We tried to talk to everyone who was going through the picket line, and we'd say things like, don't you know a labor strike is going on? Or to the undergraduates, would say, are you informed about the educational planning clause that we're trying to get? You know, it affects you as an undergraduate in your introductory courses. And I would say, in that first week of the strike, an incredibly large percentage of undergraduates were convinced to support the strike by boycotting classes as a result of one-to-one discussions with teaching assistants on the picket line.
As with most strikes, pickets were not always pleasant for strikers or other members of the university. Some who crossed picket lines complained that the TAs were abusive. TAA members also reported negative experiences on the picket lines.
In chemistry situation, it was in many cases just, you know, just vile language. I would say generally our attacks were very strongly stated attacks on the people and going through a picket line. This is a labor action. I mean, toward the end we started getting a little bit inventive, and when people would go through the picket line in Van Nuys, we would open the doors and people would stand there with shovels like they're shoveling shit.
On March 24th, a total of 5 TAs were arrested at 2 locations for blocking deliveries to campus buildings. But the strike continued throughout spring break, which Megan will continue.
Before the strike began, the legal representation for the TAA had requested that Nathan Feinsinger, a professor from the Mediation Center of the UW-Madison School of Law, work with the union and university. During the weeks that followed, he brought the TAA and university administrators back together, though not in formal bargaining sessions. Just before one of these informal talks, the mediator and an unnamed representative of the TAA suggested that the contract could simply ignore educational reform. Remember that educational reform or planning referred to TA's desire to gain greater control over the curricula of individual courses and entire departments. The university drafted such a proposal, but the Stewards Council of the TAA rejected it on March 30th and recommended that union members reject it at a forthcoming meeting. The two sides could not find a mutually satisfactory outcome. As the strike continued, some faculty went public with their opposition to the TAA's position on the issue. Pat Russian.
And there was this interesting moment of the strike, I think it was about the beginning of the third week, where 20 very prestigious professors on this campus, I can't probably even reconstruct the names, but they were people who had national, international reputations, came out with a statement saying that if the university agreed to our educational planning clause, that they would never teach at this university again. And were complaining about how it would alter their teaching of undergraduates, et cetera. But when we looked at that list and we constructed what these people, what kind of course these people taught, I think all but one didn't even have TAs. Almost all of them hadn't taught an undergraduate course in at least 5 years.
Yet some faculty remained sympathetic to the strikers. though their support had clearly defined limits. Professor Stern.
They had the right to take themselves off the payroll. Mm-hmm. But none of them had the guts to do it. This is what I said earlier. Now, they're all for the TAs and so on, but when it comes down to acting in a fashion where it meant that they also would deprive themselves of salary, they didn't do it.
The TAA faced greatly increased pressure following the Stewards Council's rejection of the drafted contract. On April 1st, the university gave over 300 TAs reduced pay and reported that other TAs might face the same fate following the next pay period. The Teamsters withdrew support, and the Circuit Court ruled in favor of the state's petition for an injunction on Friday, April 3rd. Although TAs could still exercise their right to protest, this injunction ordered them back to work on April 6th, the first day of classes following spring break. The TAA membership met on April 5th, voting to reject the drafted contract already reviewed by the Stewards Council and to continue the strike. Faculty from throughout the university met to discuss educational planning. Their meeting extended into 2 days from April 6th to 7th. This resulted in a statement allowing each department to address students' role in educational planning through its own, quote, mechanisms, end quote, as endorsed by Council of Ten Representative Mulvihill. This wording left individual students to negotiate curricular control in their departments without the support of their union. Even following the court injunction, the university had no centralized method for determining whether TAs were still on strike. Nevertheless, administrators targeted individual TAs from four departments, including German and history, and physically confirmed that they were not in their classrooms during section meeting times. They then contacted the chairs of these TAs' departments. One of these chairs was Morton Rothstein of the History Department.
Meanwhile, four department chairmen, where such absences were detected by the security people, and the affidavits were in hand, four department chairmen were asked to sign an affidavit that, according to their records, such a graduate student was supposed to meet a section in such and such a room at such and such a time. And putting those two affidavits together was the proof that the injunction that had been issued had been violated. So that those four persons who had been selected by that process were then brought before the court again, and whatever additional legal process, I guess it was a fine of $250, was put in motion, was going to be taken that way.
The next day, 21 students were served contempt citations for violating the injunction by continuing to strike. The TAA had already considered these departments to be among the most abusive to TAs prior to the strike, and the contempt citations only reinforced their position. Rothstein, however, defended his signing of that affidavit.
But looking back shortly after that and ever since, it seems to me impossible for a person who has assumed the responsibility of being an administrator of a department, in however powerless a fashion that may be, and thank God I think it is shared power in a department like ours, that you cannot refuse to report to the administration that where and when members of your staff, whether they're TAs or professors, are supposed to meet their classes.
No, certainly it's a simple thing on the face of it.
How could I refuse to withhold such information?
At a meeting on April 8th, the same day the students received the contempt citations, the ideological differences among the TAA members were laid bare as they met to discuss whether to continue, escalate, or end the strike. Some TAs suggested that picketers use physical force to prevent others from crossing their picket lines, while others suggested that the union should damage property in order to pressure the university into making concessions and bargaining. Disagreements over these suggestions did not fall along gender lines, but did push into charges of sexism within the TAA. Some female TAs believed that, while the union was organized so that all members had a say in the organization, men still limited women's voices. Lasting for over 4 hours, the meeting eventually concluded with a vote to end the strike several days later, on April 13th. On that day, TAA members would vote by paper ballot on whether to accept the new contract, which contained the faculty-proposed language on educational planning. Despite TAA members' decision not to escalate the strike, individual faculty and administrators reported isolated instances of violence and property damage in the days that followed. The home of Professor Rothstein, for example, was damaged in the early morning of April 12th, a little more than 1 day after his attendance at a faculty party celebrating the strike's conclusion.
And I guess it was the next night, Saturday night, at 2 in the morning, that I heard a window crash in our house. I was wakened by it and went to discover that a brick had been thrown through our window, and three of the other people who had signed such affidavits, at least for the ostensible targets of similar incidents.
It was that specific, was it? I wasn't quite sure.
Yes. In one case, they couldn't identify the house properly, and I'm afraid the neighbor of one of my colleagues got a window smashed instead of the chairman, but it was all aimed at that, and undoubtedly, in my judgment, had nothing to do with TA membership itself.
Individual acts of violence notwithstanding, the strike reached its end. On April 10th, the Board of Regents approved the contract's language. On April 13th, the TAA voted to accept the contract. Many throughout the university and state were uncertain as to whether the university or the TAA had won this conflict. While some administrators counted the contract as a victory, both sides seemed battle-weary and compromised. Individual faculty, including Professor Charles Scott, former chair of the English department, believed that their relationship with graduate students was forever changed.
And I guess when I think about it now, and I still feel it, I feel as though I was just absolutely filled with contempt for what was going on. The fact that we had reached this point of distrust of one another.
Others, such as Chancellor Young, believe that the TAA was powerless by the end of the strike.
But you see, the only time that there was any hope of settling with them was after they were beaten in the strike. They were losing the strike, and groups, departmental groups, were voting to go back when they then decided to call off the strike.
Department of
TAs.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were, that's where I made a decision not to destroy them as a union.
Spared in Chancellor Young's mind from destruction, many TAA members were in fact disappointed with the language of the contract.
So it ended. And how did you feel when it ended?
Everybody felt the same. Sort of let down. Everybody really felt kind of defeated, which was wrong. I mean, we sold it to ourselves as a loss. It turned what was actually a victory into a loss, I think. I think that's the most important reason that they could never pass any more strike votes.
Yet the strike ended with the first contract between a graduate student union and a university. TAA members accomplished something entirely new and did so with little support other than their own resources. Professor Rothstein.
They had already been given or had received recognition from the chancellor as a legitimate bargaining group. They could, and their election had been held. The organizational effort had borne that fruit. And, you know, looking back, it was an extraordinary organizational feat.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no one would deny that. To get that many graduate students willing to join a group and to hold an election and to win it, more recognition as the bargaining agent for teaching assistants, was quite something.
The TAA did not gain concessions as a result of the strike, but the university conceded on several issues, such as health insurance, in the days leading up to the strike deadline. TAA members did not gain collective control in educational planning through their first contract, however. The TA's ability to follow through on their threat of a strike demonstrated the seriousness they brought to their work, which strengthened their relationship with the university in future years. Troy?
Well, that's it, our first podcast. Yay! Thanks to Katie Gleichman, Ellen Jacks, and Megan Flater for their research on and creation of this piece. Thanks to Laura Smale, who conducted these interviews back in the late 1970s as part of her job as UW-Madison's oral historian. Again, thanks to the Brittingham Fund for their generosity. And last but not least, thanks to colleagues both on and off campus for their advice and support, including folks at UW-Madison Libraries, UW-Madison History Department, and the Wisconsin Historical Society. If our story of the TAA strike piqued your interest, you can access the full interviews, both the audio and the transcript, from the Campus Voices webpage at the UW Digital Collection Center's website. And look for our album on iTunes and our soon-to-be-posted mini-movie on YouTube. For full information on how to access the recordings, transcripts, iTunes album, and mini-movie, go to archives.library.wisc.edu, then click on Oral History Program, then click on Campus Voices. Easy cheesy. And last, as with my wishful introduction, I hope to have some cutesy conclusion here capturing our work in a neat bow. but that didn't happen either. So until podcast number 2, take care. Bye.